we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
The less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Happy Friday, November 16th, 2018. You're listening to Animal Voices, Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, Canada. I'm your host, Carol Davies McIntosh, and I'm joined today by my animal-loving co-host, Darren Chang, who's visiting from Toronto.
Hello.
And Allison Cole, who's operating for us.
Hello, and welcome back, Darren. It's nice to see you. See, I almost called you Daryl again. You've been away too long.
Yeah, it's always good to be back visiting Vancouver. Yeah. Happy to be here.
This show is brought to you by our sponsor, Edible Planet. Edible Planet is a Vancouver-based education campaign and TV series to teach people about the world's most powerful edible plants and the fascinating people who bring them to market. Food is the world's most powerful tool to share the wealth and chronic illness, regreen the planet, and create lasting peace today. Now's the time for a plant-based economy, because on this big, beautiful, edible planet, the food we eat can change the world. Today we're going to be covering what might seem on the surface like a bit of a contradiction. Both topics have to do with food in some way, and both have to do with compassion also. In a few minutes, we'll listen to the story of an XXL vegan who is the target of some hurtful messaging because of his weight. And then about 12:30, we'll have a chat with plant-based dietitian Desiree Nelson, who is here to guide us to eat the right foods for us to be as healthy as possible. Darren, you've got some news items for us today.
Yeah, I love doing the news. So I'll start off with some good news. So back in October, China alarmed the rest of the world when it weakened a 25-year-old ban on the trading of the body parts of tigers and rhino. But according to EcoWatch, an environmental and conservation nonprofit organization, China has restored the rhino and tiger parts ban after some international backlash. So this is good, because those two species are among some of the most endangered animals in the world. And the second news item is not so great. So PETA has conducted a series of undercover investigations on sheep farms in both England and Scotland, and they've uncovered some really frightening stuff. Most people who listen to the show would be familiar with these kinds of things, but the new footage appears to show workers swearing at the animals while kicking them and beating them. In one scene, a worker repeatedly slams a sheep's head against the floor while shouting abuse, and this is the kind of stuff that is just so normalized in animal farming and animal agriculture. It's really the violent kind of environment, treating animals as commodities and things that sort of, you know, sort of encourages otherwise good human beings to would do things like that to these innocent animals. And winter's coming up too, so wool is obviously a popular kind of clothing material and item that people like to wear to stay warm. But it's important to just keep in mind that there are humane, compassionate, vegan, non-animal alternatives out there, so that we don't have to contribute to this kind of animal cruelty and abuse. And the last news item, also winter related, one of the more popular activities in winter, I guess, there was a documentary that came out earlier this year, that exposed...
Yeah, we did an interview with the filmmaker in Animal Voices. Yes. I think it was like a year and a half ago or so. It might have been 2 years ago.
Yes. So now the animal advocacy group Animal Justice has an ongoing petition that you can find on their website, where you can contact the government of Ontario to ask them and demand them to ban the sled dog industry, because these dogs are very much mistreated. They're usually chained around a barrel for most of their lives, and they don't have a choice and a say in whether they want to participate in dragging humans around in the snow. So please help the activists who are sort of advocating for the ban of the sled dog industry in Ontario by signing this petition and sending a letter to the government of Ontario.
And check out that film, Sled Dogs.
That's
if
right.
you have a chance.
Sled
and
dog.
Also go to animalvoices.org and type in Sled Dogs, and you'll see, you'll find our interview on this subject to find out a lot more.
And Sled cool. Dogs is the name of the show?
I believe
film?
So, yeah.
Okay. Good to know. And we can put that petition up on our webpage, right?
Yeah, I think it just came out recently. So
Facebook. Okay,
sharing
good.
The link.
Great, we'll share that. And now we've got a little public service announcement to make about the voting referendum. That is, hopefully everybody is thinking about that, whether which to vote for, or to vote for first past the post, which is the situation that we have right now, which means that sometimes we can vote, sometimes 40% of the popular vote can rule the roost. Do you want that, or do you want to vote for proportional representation? So we've got a little clip here from Jordan Reichart of Animal Protection Party.
We're speaking with Jordan Reichart of the Animal Protection Party of Canada from Victoria, BC. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Jim.
So you wanted to just let our listeners know about the importance of this referendum on proportional representation. Can you just explain what that is and the importance that has for animals and the environment?
Yes. So this really is, and I've tried to stress this over the last several months, could be the most important thing we do for animals this year in BC is get proportional representation here in the referendum that's currently going on. We are asking people to vote for proportional representation and to vote in the second part of the mail-in ballot that they received for rural-urban proportional. So that's going to be the most effective system to allow candidates from smaller parties like the Animal Protection Party to get seats in the BC legislature. Now, of course, you know, come the time that we actually get proportional representation, there'll be lots of changes, but, you know, this is going to be the most empowering option, and it is our biggest opportunity to change laws protecting animals in BC, and we really need to make this happen.
And the deadline is November the 30th, correct?
Yes, so you need to have your ballots mailed in. They need to be received by Elections BC by November 30th. So please don't hesitate. Fill them out now and mail them off as soon as you can.
That's great. Thank you so much, Jordan. That was a really important message today.
Thank you, Jen. Thanks for having me on.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
And just in case you've misplaced your ballot, you can get a new one from Elections BC. So just give them a call and you can get those until the 23rd of November. So now we're going to talk about, or we're going to listen to a piece by Andy Tabar. He is half of the Bearded Vegans podcast. He's an animal rights activist and owner of Compassion Co., which is an organic vegan clothing line. Andy has completed 3 tours with the 10 Billion Lives Tour, educating people about the cruelty of animal agriculture. It goes to places like colleges throughout the United States. He's been a vegan for over 11 years, but Andy is the frequent target of body shaming. Listen as he tells his story to VegFest Colorado in August of this year.
I am Andy Tabar, and so Ginny has laid down such a great framework for us to be working off of. So I'm just going to be talking about my fat vegan body and what it's like to have a fat vegan body within this movement. I've had this body for 34 years. As many of those years as I can remember, it's been a fat body. And the last 11 years, it has been a vegan body as well. When I tell people that I've been vegan for this long, I get what I just started to call the look. And I'm sure a lot of people in this room have received that look. But you know it. Even when people try to do it subtly, it's when they look you up and down and they scan your body and they're trying to assess. And they're trying to do, in my case at least, some mental math. And they're thinking, this is not the body of the guy that's been vegan for 11 years, at least from what I've been told within this movement. And I run a vegan clothing line, so I am at a different VegFest almost every weekend of the year, which means that I'm putting this body in front of 1,000 to 30,000 people almost every weekend. So I get this look a lot. And the time that stands out to me the most was about 2 years ago. I was at this event, guy's buying a couple of shirts, I'm swiping his card, and he asks me if I'm vegan. This is a question that I get a lot when I'm doing these events. And I've asked my slim friends who come to help me out, do you get asked this question? And they'll say, occasionally, every now and then. But I get asked this question multiple times, as if people can't believe that here I am running my vegan clothing company, handing out flyers for my vegan podcast. So this guy asked me that question. He said, are you vegan? And I always respond the same way, which is, of course. Because I think, for two reasons. One, all things being equal, of course I think everyone should be vegan. And also I want to normalize the fact that this is what a vegan body can look like. It's not what every vegan body is going to look like. But there are folks that look like me in this movement. So he asked me, are you vegan? I say, of course. He comes back with, how long have you been vegan for? And I tell him, at that point, about 9 years. And his immediate response to me is, so why are you not at your ideal body weight? Yeah, right? Sit in that, soak up how awkward that feels, how just sort of, right? And in that moment, time kind of slows down. You're like, how do I respond to this question? Ideal body weight, that's such a loaded term. But what this guy was asking me when he was asking that question was essentially asking me to justify my existence in this movement. He's asking me to explain my body to him. Because he has this worldview that going vegan means the pounds are going to melt off and you're going to get rid of all your cancer and diabetes, all the stuff that Ginny was talking about, right? And he needed some reason to hold on to that. To say, I need to be able to keep promoting veganism as this way for these pounds to fall off. And I'm not sure what kind of response he was hoping to get from me. I had met this guy like a minute prior, and asking someone why they're not at their ideal body weight. It's a really awkward time to do that when they're in line buying shirts, but I try to think of, what did he want to hear? Maybe he wanted to hear, oh, actually, I used to be 500 pounds, and I'm on my journey right now. I'm getting there, because then that puts me in the category of the good fatty, right? Which is the fat person that doesn't want to be fat, and I'm working on losing that fat, because it's acceptable to be fat as long as you don't want to be fat, right? As long as you haven't found peace with your body, it's okay. Maybe he wanted me to explain a lifetime of disordered eating as if that's the kind of thing that you have a conversation with a stranger you met 30 seconds ago. Or maybe he thought I was just like, he got me. This is all a front. I'm not actually vegan. I've been sneaking that vegan food, the non-vegan food on the side. You know, whatever it is that he wanted me to justify how I dare call myself vegan and have this body, how I dare have a vegan clothing line and take up space at these events. And so I view that as a symptom of the fat shaming and the fat phobia within this movement for a lot of the reasons that Ginny was pointing out. If that is your first time hearing those terms, fat phobia, fat shaming, right, of course they're pretty self-explanatory, but fat shaming, it's about making someone feel ashamed of who they are, making someone feel embarrassed and ashamed of the physical body that they inhabit. And I think everyone in this room, fat or not, has probably felt shame about something in their lives at some point or another. It's never a good feeling. And just from that, hey, treat others how you want to be treated principle, we should realize that's not something we want to make other people feel. But I think we have this movement that has sort of been hijacked by people that see that, yes, there can be a lot of health benefits from eating fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and beans, legumes, all those things. And they think they can use that as a shortcut to animal liberation, that they can play on the existing fear of being fat in our society. And I say that because I know it sounds like hyperbolic, this fear of being fat, but there was this poll conducted, and over half the people that responded said they'd rather be dead than fat. I've had that said to my face before. I was helping someone find shirts. She tried a medium, she tried a large. They didn't fit. I offered her the extra large, and she said to her friend, I'd rather kill myself than wear an extra large. And here I am wearing a 2X. So we have this movement that's been hijacked by this because sometimes it's altruistic, right? They want to help animals. They think people are afraid of being unhealthy, of being fat. And we can tell them, we have this magic bullet, this cure-all that's going to help you. And what that results in is this movement that is very fat-phobic and very unwelcoming to people that don't fit a certain body size. So it's emblematic in things like our most popular vegan advocacy groups putting out billboards with photos of fat people that say, save the whales, or photos of fat people's thighs that say, these are your thighs on cheese. It's emblematic in our leaders for this movement, telling people if you want to be a good advocate, you must have one specific body type. You must be slim, you must be athletic. These are leaders of our movement reaching young and impressionable people that are coming in and want to do good for the animals, and they're being told, you must look one way or else you're a bad advocate. If you dare go out in public with your fat, disgusting body and tell people that you're vegan, you're just going to turn people off. You're actually hurting animals if you go out there with this body. And you can be a part of the movement, but maybe you should learn to code a website, or maybe you should learn to do some graphic design or something behind the scenes, right? And think about how many amazing activists we lose because that attitude is presented to people that are just coming on board. And it's emblematic in the fact that we have documentaries in this movement that feature weight loss surgeons. So let that sink in. That's someone whose livelihood depends on people being unhappy with their bodies to the point where they'll pay someone to suck fat out of it. Documentaries featuring weight loss surgeons saying that this movement for us to be comfortable with our bodies has us comfortable with being sick, which is, of course, entirely untrue. But this is the type of movement that we're in, and it's, of course, very hostile and unwelcoming to a lot of folks, myself included. So when I bring this stuff up, there's usually two types of responses that I get. And the first one is someone that's just saying, I'm not trying to hurt anyone's feelings. I'm just trying to spread the good word. I'm trying to let people know how unhealthy it is to be fat, that I found the way forward. I know the way to eat that will make you not fat anymore. And the first thing I'll say about that is, newsflash, there's not a single fat person on this planet that hasn't been told that they're unhealthy or undesirable or lazy or unethical pretty much every day of their lives. It's a message that's in all media that we consume, sometimes subtle, sometimes not so subtle. So the next time anyone thinks about posting stuff like that, like, rest assured, the job has been done. We've received the message loud and clear, not adding anything new or novel to the conversation. But as Ginny pointed out, shaming does not work. On my podcast, we did an episode where we explored whether guilt was an effective motivator for making social change, and that led us to explore the differences between guilt and shame. And guilt is when you feel bad about a thing that you've done, and shame is when you feel bad about who you are as a person. And through all the psychological research, everything we were looking at, we found out that, in fact, shame is not a good motivator. In fact, it drives people further into the behaviors that they are made to feel shameful about. So if you think that it's helping to bring these things up and point them out to people that have already received that message, it's actually doing the exact opposite of those things. And of course, it lends itself to, again, making all these activists that want to join this movement that are here feeling like they can't fully be an activist because they can't be on the front lines, they can't participate because they're ashamed of it. And I have people come up to my booth all the time, people that look like me, and say, I love that design. Oh my God, I love that design. That's amazing. I would wear that, but I don't want people to know that I'm vegan because of the body that I have. I don't want people to associate this body with veganism. And I think it's so important, as Jane was pointing out, to have diverse representation. I used to travel the country. I did this for about 2 years on and off, doing pay-per-view activism. We paid people $1 to watch a four-minute video about the treatment of animals on farms. Afterwards, we talked to them about going vegan. And I talked to so many people that looked like me that said, oh, you're vegan? Like, I didn't realize people like you that looked like you were vegan. And I've been kind of interested in this, and I wanted to give it a shot, but I thought it was only for skinny white women that do yoga and drink green smoothies every morning. And no shade at those people, right? Because again, all things being equal, I think everyone should be vegan. We need everyone. We need the skinny white women talking to the skinny white women, but we need the fat guys talking to fat people as well. And if we hide those people, think about the huge portion of the population that we're shutting ourselves off to. Because the whole world doesn't look one way or even wants to look one specific way, no matter what people tell you. Not everyone wants to be a bodybuilder or a triathlete or whatever it might be. And I'm so glad we have amazing vegan bodybuilders and triathletes out there because they're so crucial. But we need everyone on board. And so the other response that I get when I bring this stuff up is people just say, life's unfair, grow a thick skin, people are mean, get over it, get out there and help the animals. People say, it shouldn't matter if vegans are mean to other people because veganism is a just and righteous cause. So people need to do it regardless. And I agree with that. I agree that if it's the right thing to do, you do the right thing regardless of how mean people are. But why do we want to put obstacles in our path? Why do we want to have a conversation with someone where they're just like, but wait, my body is not right and I'm not eating the right thing? Wouldn't we rather be talking about how many animals we can save? Wouldn't we rather have the right conversation instead of driving people away? And I have plain thick skin. I've been dealing with this for a very, very long time. But when that guy asked me why I was not at my ideal body weight, the response that I did give to him was, I am at my ideal body weight. And it just came right out. Thank you. And it's not because I don't have bad body image days or I'm above all of this. I'm certainly not. I'm still in the thick of it like most people. But it wasn't until I started to accept this body before I became a confident activist and could put myself out there. You know, I've yo-yo dieted up and down, 100 pounds up and down over the years. And it wasn't until I stopped doing that and stopped looking at the scale that I truly felt at peace with myself. And I think that as a movement, we should be working to get everyone to that point. Because I think that we all deserve to be comfortable in our own skin. And the animals are in a state of emergency, and they need every single body working for them, regardless of how we look. Thank you.
When I first heard this on the Bearded Vegans podcast, I was really shaken. I was very sad, and it hurt me that this brave man who goes out there and fights for animals was being shamed and brutalized by people who didn't seem to understand. And I'm glad he's got a thick skin, but we really need to look at being part of a compassionate organization, movement. Why are we doing this to each other? Is that something that you have felt in your life? I know that for me, I'm a little bit older than most of the people in this organization or in this movement, and sometimes I don't feel like I quite fit in. And it's not really through anything overt, but there's just a little tug at me, I guess. And so I have to have a little bit thick skin too, to be able to walk out into and do the things that we need to do for animals. What about you, Darren?
Well, first I just want to say I'm really grateful that people like Andy are sharing these stories, because they're so important and they really need to be heard. It's a demonstration of, you know, at that individual level, how people experience, you know, fat phobia, fat shaming, and body shaming in general, and how it is so harmful for both the individuals who are vegan, but also those who are not yet vegan and are considering, and the movement as a whole. Like, our effectiveness to communicate with others is just so negatively impacted by that. But I think it's also important to kind of zoom out a little bit and understand that body shaming, or this kind of assumption that an ideal body exists, is very much a broader cultural and social issue. And I think it's on all of us to be critically conscious of the fact that, you know, which types of body that we desire are in large part shaped and reinforced and constructed, you know, by the powers that be, that seek to, oftentimes it's for the sake of profiting through the control of people's bodies and people's insecurities, because, you know, through advertising, that is just such a common way that companies and corporations that are trying to sell you clothes or any kind of fashion items or anything like that are able to get to people through that kind of insecurity. So it's important to, I guess, acknowledge that this issue isn't unique to the vegan movement, but it does take on kind of its own specific sort of really insidious version within the vegan movement because of the health dimension of it.
I was going to say that I would, as Andy was saying, I would hate for someone not to want to wear a shirt that said you're vegan because they feel that their body is too big to display this shirt.
Exactly.
I think that's sad. That's against what we want to be doing for the animals and for a message of animal compassion and animal liberation. And I will say myself that veganism is not a weight loss diet. I was 50 pounds heavier than I am now. You probably both don't know this, not that long ago, and I was vegan. It's not a weight loss. I got heavier when I got vegan. I gained weight when I got vegan. So that's a falsity, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And I just, as Darren was saying, it is body shaming in the vegan movement is just a small portion of body shaming in whole in our society,
which
is really unfortunate, because I really, I actually appreciate when the vegan community gets together, because I really do feel there's a diversity of all different shapes and sizes and looks and ages, and I feel that we're welcoming and it's a welcoming community.
Yeah, so I do think definitely as a movement, veganism, as vegans, as being part of a movement that is all about compassion and liberation, that, you know, it's even more of an obligation on our part to be, to make sure that our movement is diverse and is inclusive of everybody, regardless of body types, shapes, sizes, and, you know, other identities, whether it's race or gender or age, all these issues. You know, we have a lot of work to do.
And I think it's just good for us to be aware and to hear these stories you know, put ourselves in their shoes. And, you know, I don't know how he has the guts to get up and do that, because I sure wouldn't. He's a better man than me. It's also natural, though, for us to want our fellow activists to be healthy for their sake. And I think that there's some overlap there with it's not a shaming thing, and it's not a shaming thing about what, if you want to eat just pizza and donuts, I don't want to shame you for that, but I may be concerned for your health. And I think that's a natural caring thing that you would do for a friend or a family member or anything. But the actual shaming piece, that needs to stop. I do want to talk about the health aspect, and this is how I think this dovetails into what we have coming up next, who we have in the studio today. We have Desiree Nielsen. She's sitting here listening to this, she was biting her tongue, I think, throughout that discussion. She's a Vancouver-based registered dietitian, an author, and an ambassador for the good for you life. She runs a nutrition consulting practice with a focus on inflammation, digestion, and plant-centered diets. She also hosts The Urban Vegetarian on Gusto TV very, very early on Friday mornings, I think 5:30.
At this point, yeah, it's kind of in the rerun land.
Okay. And is a co-founder of My Healthy Gut, which is a research-backed iOS app for digestive health. She's got two books on anti-inflammatory nutrition, one currently available through Amazon and bookstores called Unjunk Your Diet, How to Shop, Cook, and Eat to Fight Inflammation and Feel Better Forever. And her new cookbook called Eat More Plants, 100 Anti-Inflammatory Plant-Centered Recipes for Vibrant Living is scheduled for release in August 2019. All this... and she's the mom of two young children and an avid gardener. Desiree joins us to talk about transitioning to whole foods plant-based diet from wherever you are now. Welcome, and thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I just wanted to tell a little story about my experience with dietitians. I've been to two different dietitians, but I didn't find either one of them to be very helpful. They were both linked in with hospitals, so I guess it was an outpatient situation. Neither knew much about plant-based diets, and neither had a sample vegetarian or vegan diet that they could provide me with. They ended up giving me a diabetes diet and scratching out, you know, 4 ounces of lean whatever chicken and putting in beans, which really wasn't helpful because, as we know, chicken and beans have completely different nutrition profiles. So how, you know, so it wasn't really helping me. So can you explain the role of a dietitian?
Dietitians work in a lot of different settings. So as you said, your experience was with someone in the hospital. And so they're working very much on kind of clinical disease. So I work in private practice, which in all honesty is a bit of a luxury. When people walk through my door, they've already thought, but maybe I need to make some change. Maybe I should get some help. They're willing to pay for that help. And so when they sit down, they're really ready for work. So what I do as a dietitian, I really consider myself a partner and a collaborator in your health. So my role is to take everything I know about nutrition research, everything I know about kind of the practical brass tacks of feeding yourself on a daily basis, mm-hmm. and helping merge that to fit your lifestyle, your choices around the foods that you want to eat, and then your health goals.
Right. Okay. So now you mentioned people were willing to pay. Now, is there, your services aren't covered by BC Medical?
So in private practice, so when you see someone in a hospital, yes, the medical system is paying for it. When you see someone in private practice, you pay up front, but then many people have coverage via their extended health. It's different employer to employer, but a lot of people have coverage up to $500 to come and see a dietitian, and they don't realize that they have it.
Right. So use it if you've got it.
Dietitians should be free, but until that day comes, use your extended health.
Because exactly.
Everyone, including myself sometimes, needs a little like plug-in of some nutrition advice.
Right. So we hear this term, whole foods, plant-based diet. And I'm just wondering about it. What exactly is whole foods plant-based diet? So we, as vegans, we're, you know, yeah, we know what plant-based is, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we're doing whole foods, right?
Exactly. And I think, you know, when you look at a vegan diet, essentially the dividing line, is there any ingredient of animal origin in this? If not, it's vegan. Mm-hmm. To go whole foods plant-based, the bar goes a little further. So it's, are these foods that are as close to how they grew out of the ground as possible? So it's an apple, not apple juice.
Right.
It is brown rice, not, you know, brown rice bread. So as whole and as simple and unadulterated as possible. So we're eating the vegan basics, fruits, vegetables, legumes, nuts, seeds, whole grains.
Okay.
So elaborating on the whole foods plant-based diet, would you be able to tell us a bit about what are some of the positive health implications, as well as some of the things that we should be cautious about when adopting this diet?
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm really passionate about going towards a more whole foods plant-based diet is the fact that, I mean, nature provides everything that we need, you know, except for that little bit of B12. Nature provides everything that we need to be nourished. So when you're eating whole foods, a bunch of things happens. The first is you're getting way more fiber. Fiber is very filling. It helps you to be satisfied. Sometimes when people are transitioning and they just pull the meat out of their diet, they're like, I'm starving all the mm-hmm. time. But if you just eat a little bit of pasta, there's not much to physically fill you up and tell your brain and your body that you've received enough food.
Right.
The other thing that's really important with that fiber is it helps to feed your gut microbes. And the research is showing us more and more what you do and what you feed your gut microbes is so critical for overall health. So they need a lot of fiber. And so eating all those fruits, vegetables, legumes are really going to help you get there. The other thing, having a gut and an anti-inflammatory focus, plants are incredible medicine. Like as we said before, mm-hmm. all the phytochemicals that are intact in whole foods, not intact in hyper-processed foods, help protect you against daily stressors and the everyday life, the pollution, all of these kind of things we encounter, and help support cellular regeneration so we can stay healthy and energized and vibrant.
So how would they do that? How do they work that way?
Yeah, so our body is equipped with all of these healing mechanisms. Otherwise, we couldn't, you know, we wouldn't make it another day. You know, life is messy. And just in the normal course of human metabolism, there are something called reactive oxygen species that are formed. And our body has cleanup mechanisms to take care of these. The challenge is the more burden we put on these cleanup mechanisms, the faster they get spent. Aging is our cleaning and repair mechanisms getting spent.
Okay.
So what we do is we eat all of these whole plant foods, and all of the vitamins, minerals, and phytochemicals essentially recharge, reinforce, and resupport our body's ability to repair itself so that we don't feel the at first fatigue and then the inflammatory right. effects of all of these changes.
Okay. So what are some common dietary missteps that you would see when people change to a plant-based diet?
So the first I already alluded to, and I often will see people, not usually when they transition, but I find in that 9 to 12 month mark after they have is really common, because they're like, why do I feel A, hungry all the time, B, super exhausted, and C, why am I gaining weight? And so what I see is that often people will just remove the meat from a plate. They will remove the animal foods from a plate and not replace those with their plant-based equivalents. So getting more of those legumes, getting more of those whole soy foods on your plate so that you're providing the vitamins and minerals that were before given to you by your animal foods, because they're there in plant foods. You just have to make them a part of our plate. So that's probably the biggest thing that I see.
So as they hit that mark, is that when we see a lot of people giving up? Because there seems to be, it seems to be that there's a, people have a hard time sometimes sticking to a plant-based diet, even just plant-based. I mean, not even whole foods plant-based, which is a little, like you said, it's a little bit higher bar, right? So what can we do to help make that transition a little more smooth?
So one of the things that I tell people is I really encourage you to plan ahead. I know that we can hear all this amazing messaging and we're like, tomorrow, that's it.
Yeah.
But I encourage people to give themselves a timeline, like this is my start date, and then start gradually working towards it. So what do I eat for breakfast all the time? If I remove the animal products from it, what am I replacing them with? To make sure that at home, they know how to transform their diet and make those swaps. So really planning ahead. The other thing is to consider all of the times when you're not in control of your foodstuffs, because I think that's often the hardest point, where you find yourself out and about and you're starving and there are no plant-based options. And so that's when you either are like, you know, rice cakes in the bag, or that's when you start to say, oh, well, this is getting too difficult. So make sure that you know your options. Make sure that you talk to the people around you. Our social circles are also very important. If you are the first person to go plant-based in your social circle, what do you do when you go to a dinner party? What do you do when you're dining at a restaurant together? Do you feel confident enough to share a plant-based restaurant, or at least one that's very plant-based friendly? So make sure you are planning ahead, considering your social circle, and then also get a little bit of advice. I really encourage it. Know what your key nutrients are. Know where you're going to get them from. Have that check-in so that you can be so nourished and energized and feel so amazing doing this, as opposed to the opposite, that it's its own built-in motivation.
Okay. You mentioned blood sugar levels, basically, like fatigue, like people, you know, not feeling full and things like that. One of the things that I picked up off of your website was that people miss the meaty flavors, and you suggested adding some smoky kind of flavors into your diet to sort of replicate that feel, that taste.
Yeah. And particularly, you know, when people are missing those flavors, so they're doing this because they want to care for animals, and so they still have those taste buds.
Right.
I really, and this is the time, even though I advocate for a more whole foods, plant-based diet, this is the time to really bring in those alternatives that maybe help you transition,
right.
you know, like the Beyond Meat burgers and all those kind of things. But then in the plant world, it is so often about taste. So I'm a huge smoked tofu fan. It's like one of my favorite plant-based hacks, because particularly it's not, because it's not something you have to cook either. You're like, oh, I have a craving, or oh, I have like a salad that I need some like protein on.
Right.
All you do is you slice it up. You
can
eat it straight out of the package.
I often eat it straight.
And here's the tip. If you live in Vancouver, there are usually $2 each at Sunrise Market, where I'm going to after the show to get some.
Exactly. That market is amazing, by the way. It's so good. People are like, I can't eat well on a budget. Yes, you can. You go to Sunrise.
Yes, you go to Sunrise. $10-$15 full of groceries.
Totally.
Now, I've also read about protein being needing more protein if it's plant-based than if it's animal-based. I'm not sure about that. What do you think?
Oftentimes, particularly in the traditional recommendations, you will see because of digestion and nutrient availability within plant foods, because plant cells have a hard cell wall, unlike right. animal cells. Mm-hmm. So your body physically has to work to break them down and harness what's inside. So you'll often see a slightly higher recommendation for things like protein, iron, zinc, all those minerals that are sometimes like 1.5 times, you know, so that like a woman needing iron, they're recommending like over 20 milligrams of iron a day, which is actually pretty difficult to do, even if you're super healthy. What I often say is focus on the general recommendations first. Okay. So, you know, if you need about 75 grams of protein, aim for that. And only if for some reason you think your blood sugars are not being well controlled or you're a little bit fatigued and you're meeting it already, then you might consider you just need a little bit more in this new plant-based you.
Okay. So inflammation seems to be one of your pet projects. Can we talk about that? What are some risks in inflammation? What happens to the body when we get an inflammation response?
Yeah, so, you know, I've been talking about anti-inflammatory nutrition for like a decade now. And a decade ago, it was pretty woo-woo and out there. And now we know that it's just the way. So inflammation is an action of your immune system. So it's absolutely critical for your survival. However, just like stress is important and serves a function, but mm-hmm. it's not good when it's chronic, it's the same thing with inflammation. So inflammation, you don't necessarily walk around knowing you're inflamed, but you're like, oh, maybe my joints are a little bit achy, or oh, maybe I've got eczema all of a sudden, or my gut's really weird all of a sudden. And so that's just one of the signs that maybe your immune system is overacting. It's lost that balance between tolerance and action. And where we see it occurring is from a lot of things. So less than healthy diet, so that hyper-processed diet as opposed to more whole foods diet. Stress is a huge component. Stress is enough to inflame you. Even if you eat all the kale and like edamame in the world, stress can inflame you.
So we need to meditate as well as eating whole foods.
And take time outside, right? Take care of our bodies so that we can take care of others. That's, you know, put your own oxygen mask on first.
Exactly.
Smoking can inflame you, as is inactivity. And so from the dietary perspective, there's a couple of things that we look at. So the first is providing anti-inflammatory nutrients. So that's getting all the colorful foods. That helps. The other thing is getting the right kinds of fats. So it's not about low fat. It's about quality of fats. And of course, these are plant fats, which makes it pretty easy on a plant-based diet. But avocados, extra virgin olive oil, nuts, seeds, getting enough omega-3. It's a classic anti-inflammatory fat from hemp and chia and ground flax. Then we also want to watch blood sugars.
Okay.
Because when we have massive blood sugar spikes, if it's your birthday and you have some cake, it's really no big deal. But if every day you're drinking a lot of sweetened drinks, having a lot of those highs and lows, every time you spike inflammation. And so you want to make sure that you're getting protein at every meal. It's not just pasta on a plate.
Now, why protein at every meal?
So protein helps slow stomach emptying, which is a good thing. People are like, oh, protein, I'm bloated, it's hard to digest. You want it to be harder to digest because it slows the rate at which the contents of your stomach enter the small intestine, which therefore slows the rate at which the contents of your small intestine get ingested, digested, and absorbed into the bloodstream. You also want tons of fiber. The things that help slow blood sugar rise are fiber, protein, healthy fats, and ironically, a bit of acid. So having a bit of lemon juice on your salad, for example, also helps to make sure you get a nice slow bump in blood sugars. It sustains your energy levels. It also helps you control your hunger, because when your blood sugars drop, your brain thinks you're starving. Even if you just had like a 700 calorie muffin, you think you're starving. So having those blood sugars in control are really important. And then the final piece of that inflammation is feeding your gut bacteria, and fiber takes care of that for you.
Okay, so plant fiber is very different, right? It's insoluble, or a lot of it is.
So there are a lot. We're learning that there are multiple types. So we have the insoluble, that's the plant cell wall. Mm-hmm. There's soluble in things like barley and oats, which is very gel-like. Mm-hmm. There are also other forms like resistant starch. So this is if you cook and cool potatoes, for example, or cook and cool rice. It changes the starch so that it's less digestible to you and more digestible to your microbes. And then there are other components of plant foods, which if you have IBS or irritable bowel syndrome, you know them as the FODMAPs. So things like fructose in apples or fructan chains in grains. And those, again, you don't digest and absorb, so they feed gut bacteria.
So, and we don't know whether they're good gut bacteria or bad bacteria. Is that right?
Yeah. And so that's why, you know, someone with IBS, like myself, at one point had really bad gut bacteria. So you don't want to feed them. So you starve them out for a little bit and then right. work on feeding the right ones. But for everyone who just wants to be preventative, mm-hmm. but also foster an environment where the right bacteria grow, mm-hmm. eating tons of plant foods does that for you.
Now, I hear people complain when they go plant-based and they say, you know, I've got so much gas and I got stomach aches and I've got diarrhea and it's horrible. And I, you know, what's that about and how do we avoid that?
Yeah, it's definitely a topic I'm particularly passionate about because everybody toots. First off, everybody toots. And if you go Whole Foods plant-based, you're going to toot a little bit more for a while.
For a while, though. That's the key, right?
Yeah, I think that's the key. So that your body is changeable and adaptable. And so as you start eating more fiber, you are going to change your microbes to ones that are better able to handle it. Your digestive secretions will also become better at handling it. There are certain foods that are more gas-producing, broccoli, cauliflower, for example. But a toot-free life is not possible, nor is it something that you want, because everyone makes liters of gas a day. But as you move slowly, drink tons of water, move your body because it helps with proper digestion, it will lessen over time.
Okay. Darren, you look like you had something to say.
Right. I was going to ask you about something you've discussed in one of your blogs about spacing out eating and the frequency of meals. So what would you say is wrong with this practice of just grazing all day long versus spacing out our meals?
Yeah, you know, and it really depends. So something that I'm most passionate about is people need to eat in a way that feels most comfortable and beneficial to them. Some people love to graze all day, and if you feel good and vital and healthy doing that, that's fine. Coming from my digestive world, but even just as a dietitian, we now snack so much that if we are trying to manage our health or manage our inflammation, every time we eat is an opportunity to eat more than we need. And I think that we override our natural hunger signal. So that's important. It's important to tune into your hunger signals. But from a digestive perspective, when your gut is not doing so well, every time you eat, you probably feel worse. And particularly from the standpoint of gut bacteria, a lot of people can have an overgrowth of gut bacteria, of the wrong kind of bacteria. Mm-hmm. And so every time you eat, you kind of wash that area in nutrients that helps those gut bacteria thrive. And so for my clients with like IBS or bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine, we know that if you space your meals, you know, maybe 4 to 5 hours apart, what happens is that you turn on this really cool neurological wave, because you've got all these nerves in your gut called the migrating motor complex. And what that's meant to do, it's essentially like a rinse cycle for your gut, just like you have on your dishwasher, but it only turns on in what we call the post-absorptive state. So after you've digested and absorbed your food, and genetically it's different, maybe half hour, 45 minutes, an hour after that, this wave turns on. It helps clean your gut, sweep everything along so that you have proper transit and elimination, mm-hmm. But also so that if you have any tendency to overgrowth of bacteria, they get swept along too.
Okay. So we need to let our body do its work with the fuel that we've given it before we load it up again.
particularly, you know, like for someone who has no gut issues, if you are hungry, please snack. But I think it's the constant snacking overriding your hunger signals and not listening to what your body really needs. And then if you have that digestive inflammatory stuff, this approach might be a beneficial one for you.
Okay, that's good to know. I did have bacterial overgrowth, and I did treat it differently through herbs and things like that through with my naturopath. But medical doctors aren't quite, they think it's a fad thing, I guess. But, you know, I'd actually got tested and stuff like that for it. And I noticed a big difference after it took about a month to treat it, and I noticed a big difference from that. I wanted to throw out the phytic acid, or the phytates, because it's in beans and legumes, etc., all the good stuff, and people are crazy about it. Is it an evil mineral stealer or a helpful antioxidant?
I love that question, particularly because these days the thing is floating around that, you know, plants don't want to be eaten and phytates are their, like,
right. That's right.
that's their getting you back.
Yeah.
Really, and we call them anti-nutrients, which is the worst. First, you have to kind of debunk that whole anti-nutrient and what it means, because instinctively and intuitively it means something terrible.
Right.
Fiber is an anti-nutrient too. So people need to wrap their hand around it. It means it doesn't have nutritive value to you, and that it can potentially bind other minerals. You eat a ton of fiber, it can bind minerals. And so people get really concerned about phytates in food because they bind minerals. Something that you have to remember is they are also found in very mineral-rich food. They're not like evil nutrient sponges that are going to, like, steal up all your calcium and iron. It means that in the food that they are in, you might absorb less of the calcium and iron found in that food only. This is only an issue for someone with a really high raw or super high fiber plant-based diet. And even then, you can get around it. Cooking reduces, particularly in grains, cooking reduces most of the phytate in food. Same thing with legumes. Soaking, for people who do a ton of nuts, soaking reduces a lot of them as well. So if you're worried about minerals, cooking, soaking, sprouting really helps you get past it, but it doesn't mean plants are not good for you. Okay. And in fact, it does actually have antioxidant ability in the body and may decrease your risk of disease.
Oh, so there you go. So it's not evil.
No.
Now, what about supplements? Processed food has various supplements added to it, like vitamin D, calcium, iron, etc. So as we change to a more whole foods diet, should we be looking at taking these supplements? Because the food that is processed has it in there. So do we need to take them?
Yeah, so I'm a big believer both that good, healthy, whole food provides almost everything that we need, but also because I see it in my practice that the right and judicious use of supplements can really be beneficial. On a whole foods diet, I'm still a big fan of B12 supplementation. Some people will do it through food, but we also have to remember on a plant-based diet that generally it's also added. So if we're doing, you know, nut milks,
right,
at home, we don't have the B12,
yeah,
but we get them in our you know, purchased almond milk. I'm also a big fan of vitamin D, but everyone needs it. Even omnivores need it, because vitamin D is made through our skin. And here in Vancouver, we do not make it between essentially October and May. And so I'm a big fan of people taking vitamin D because it's such an important immunomodulator. Those are really the two biggies. Calcium, omega-3. If you plan your diet out well, you really don't need a supplement. And then the other thing that we had talked about is iodine.
Mm-hmm.
We forget about iodine on a plant-based diet. And it wasn't a big deal when we all used, like, good old-fashioned iodized salt, but now that there's all these amazing culinary salts, they're not a stable source of iodine, nor is all the seaweed you would need to eat on a daily basis.
Is there a lot? We'd have to eat a lot of seaweed?
You'd have to eat a decent amount, and so it's not the most reliable source. So I really encourage people on a plant-based diet to actually use good old-fashioned salt.
Table salt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or you can get supplements, I think, too, can't you? For iodine?
You can. If you choose to take a multivitamin, like particularly women of childbearing age, and you want that extra iron and folate, then it's going to be in your multivitamin, and you don't have to worry about it.
Okay. Little is known about one of my favorite nutrients, choline. It's required to promote optimum health and to prevent chronic diseases. I go to Linus Pauling Institute website a lot because I really like their research and stuff.
Great one.
And what they say is that pure vegetarians, so no meat or eggs, so in other words, you know, no animal products at all, may be at risk of inadequate choline intake. I had a choline deficiency, and it manifested itself by creating fat in my liver. So it took me, none of the doctors, nobody helped me with it. I had to do the research on my own, but I did find I did find choline as an issue, and I ended up taking choline supplements, and when I had my next liver scan, it was gone.
Amazing.
And so it just astonished me that this information isn't out there. Now, I don't know whether genetically I'm predisposed to have a problem that way or what, but I just wanted to get that message out there.
And, you know, and it's amazing because it's also something that I don't talk about enough. And so when we spoke previously, I was like, it hit home for me again. There isn't much that we know about choline because it wasn't until recently that they actually had an official recommendation for choline even as a nutrient. And so for many people, it would fall off the radar. And, you know, it seems like on a plant-based diet, we're getting far less than that. But then why the symptoms don't manifest in everyone and why they do in others, genetics, age, ethnicity, there's so much that we don't know. But it's important to note, particularly childbearing age, or if anything is off in your health, it would be really worthwhile considering a choline supplement because the amounts found in food, like it's really soy products that have the most, and it's relatively scant in other foods.
Okay. So we're, I think we're almost out of time here.
I think so.
Darren, yeah. Do you have something else?
Sure. So you can actually, before we get there, you can find out more about Desiree's work at DesireeRD.com. And there's also an iOS app, the My Healthy Gut app, that you can download for your phone. So you have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada. Please join us for our next show on Friday, November 23rd. Sinead Sanders will be interviewing Elizabeth Ormandy of Animals in Science Policy Institute about fish intelligence and what a fish knows. Today's show was brought to you by Edible Planet, a Vancouver-based education campaign and TV series to teach people about the world's most powerful edible plants and the fascinating people who bring them to the market. Food is the world's most powerful tool to share the wealth and chronic illness, regreen the planet, and create lasting world peace today. Now is the time for a plant-based economy because on our big, beautiful edible planet, the food we eat can change the world. We want to connect with you online. You can stream shows, download our podcasts, read the show blog, and subscribe via iTunes at animalvoices.org. Stay in touch with us on Facebook at Animal Voices Vancouver and join us on Twitter at animalvoicesyvr. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We will be closing today's show with the Beatles song Savoy Truffles, written by George Harrison about a box of chocolates and Eric Clapton's very sweet tooth. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.